It's Philosophy Talk.
May I speak to you for a minute?
How does time fit into the furniture of the universe?
Go. You have 58 seconds.
Well, in glancing at your books, I noticed that in the columns...
You have 48 seconds left. Hurry, hurry.
The past has already happened. The future hasn't happened yet.
If only the present moment exists, where does the future come from?
I glance at your books, I notice in the...
28 seconds! You're running out of time! Tick-tock,
Mr. Bialystok, I cannot function under these conditions! You're making me extremely nervous!
Time keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into the future.
Where does time come from?
Is time just a construct of the mind?
Our guest is Julian Barber, author of The End of Time.
Sorry, the 5 minutes is up.
That was never 5 minutes just now.
I'm afraid it was.
The reality of time.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken and I teach philosophy.
And today, we're thinking about the reality of time.
Well, Ken, nothing seems more basic or real than time. I mean, every moment confirms the existence of time. Yet many philosophers, from Zeno of Elea to Augustine to many others, find it deeply puzzling. And some, like John Ellis MacTaggart, even claimed with fancy argumentation that time is unreal.
Now, this is supposed to be news, John. A bunch of philosophers doubting the reality of something that seems so obvious and irresistible to everybody else. That's news.
Well, the news is it's not just philosophers. It's physicists. Like Stephen Hawking, he wrote a book on the short history of time, but lately he's been saying, well, time, maybe it's unreal.
Yeah.
So it's that's news.
Yeah, that's news. But you know what? Still, I don't get it. What does it even mean to say that time is unreal? Is that denying that there's such a thing as the past or the present or the future? Is that denying that we're not moving from past to present into the future? I don't get it.
Well, let me explain how I get my mind around it to the extent that I do. Imagine I've got a very detailed calendar on my wall. It's basically a list of events. Last week's pizza party, yesterday's meeting with the dean, tomorrow's dentist appointment. Now, no physicist is going to convince me that the things in the little boxes on my calendar don't occur. Events happen. Things change.
Well, right. Exactly. You're making my point. Isn't that precisely what the physicist is supposed to do? He's supposed to give us a grand theory of how all the events in the universe, from the past down to the present into the future, unfold through time. Isn't a physicist who denies the reality of time so denying the reality of the events and the change that you were talking about? I don't get it.
Well, that seems to me where there's a bit of room for maneuver. Because think about this super detailed calendar divided into years, months, weeks, days, hours, and even minutes. I mean, that's quite a bit of structure that really goes beyond our experience of everyday events, right? The structure imposes a strict order on the events, and they fall either into the past or the future, or except for this particular moment we call now.
But I'm not sure I'm following a calendar. Sure, it's a useful framework for organizing our experiences and our managing our plans and expectations and all that. But are you saying that it's a good model for what time really is? I'm not sure I follow.
No, I'm saying that it may be a useful framework for those of us with a kind of earthbound existence. But, you know, once we thought the Earth was flat into the center of the universe, we had this framework that works well for a lot of purposes. But maybe our concept of time is limited or even false in that way. So would it be too alarming if a physicist were to say, surprise, you have this completely wrong view of how these events fit together. Your concept of time is just over simple and lacking, and it's really not real.
Well, I guess I get it. I mean, physicists do that to us all the time. They're always embarrassing common sense. So you're suggesting that common sense ideas like before and after, today, tomorrow, yesterday, and so on, they're all just a framework that maybe helps us organize events from a human perspective, but aren't really real?
Right. When we, or rather the physicists, look at the vastness of the cosmos and the intricacies of quanta and try to come up with a theory that makes sense of all of it, it could turn out that our little earthly framework of before and after and time doesn't fit very well.
But that implies that our framework for segmenting and measuring time is something maybe purely subjective with no objective reality. But then what about change, John? Change is real. That's not just subjective. Some people say, yeah, it's just subjective impressions, but then the impressions change, so you still got change. And once you've got real change in the universe, don't you have real time? I don't get it.
Well, I think we need some time to think about that. And then maybe we'll change our minds and come to see that change is not real either.
Well, now you're just talking in paradoxes, John.
Well, today's paradox is tomorrow's grant proposal and maybe the day after tomorrow's insight.
But I thought you didn't believe in today's or tomorrow's.
Well, I do for now because just recently we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, out to learn how people throughout history and across cultures have measured this thing or non-thing we call time. She files this report.
When you're bored or in pain, time goes by so slowly.
Boring.
When you're busy, happy, or in love, time moves fast.
Oh, let the good times roll.
People have been trying to measure time forever. Ancient Egyptians had shadow clocks. Romans had sundials. And in 6th century China, people used candle clocks that marked the passage of time by melting.
If you come in my house, you're faced with a very large stand on which is a church clock dating from about 1750 with a 9-foot pendulum.
Jeffrey Hollis says his clock rather dominates the house.
I have a very patient wife.
Hollis is a member of the Antiquarian Horological Society in the UK, a group of hobbyists who study old-timey devices that measure time.
I'm just fascinated by the regularity of clocks, the different sorts, and I think it's something to do with an innate feature of mankind. We like regularity, we like order. Nothing can beat the regularity of a clock.
Hollis says early clocks didn't have dials, they were more like bells.
That actually is the earliest function of clocks. The word clock derives from the word bell, and they were introduced probably in the 12th or 13th century to ring bells so that monks could keep accurately to their services.
According to Hollis, it might go all the way back to Saint Benedict.
In 530 AD, he introduced the idea of a regular cycle of prayer. Monks had to pray 7 times a day, and he set down the hours.
So monks would hear a distant bell and then ring their own, almost like a game of telephone, but with timekeeping bells.
And in fact, this is where we get the well-known nursery rhyme about Frère Jacques, dormez-vous, sonnez la mattina, because it was a terrible thing if the monk in charge of the calling his colleagues fell asleep.
By the 13th and 14th centuries, clocks were status symbols.
Just as today, cities all around the world have to have museums and art galleries to attract people, in those days they had to have complicated astronomical clocks.
An astronomical clock has wheels representing the movement of the sun, moon, and planets, in addition to the time of day. Hollis says in battles, the victor would sometimes take the astronomical clock of the vanquished as a trophy.
This was in 1382. Philip the Bold of Burgundy defeated the Flemish burghers at Rosbeck and punished them by taking away their clock.
Another key development was the pendulum clock, invented by a Dutch scientist in the mid-17th century. The scientist was inspired by Galileo's fascination with pendulums. Galileo had discovered that the time it takes a pendulum to swing is approximately the same, no matter the size of the swing.
The invention of the pendulum meant that ordinary people could now afford a decent timekeeper, and this radically changed people's approach to time. It meant that now people could really do things in common.
These new timekeepers allowed people to work together more efficiently and came in handy as people moved into cities and started working by the hour. These days, everyone has access to time measurement. There are even clocks that are so precise, like the quantum logic clock, that if it ran for another 3.5 billion years, it wouldn't even be off by a second. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. Thanks, Caitlin. We'll try to give a measured response to your interesting report. With me here at KALW is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about the reality of time. And we're joined now by Julian Barber. He's a visiting professor of physics at the University of Oxford. He's author of The End of Time, The Next Revolution in Physics. Julian, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, I think it's good morning with you in California, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Good morning.
Yes, yes. Thanks for joining us. Now, Julian, in my amateur reading, a lot of contemporary physicists seem to find time kind of a embarrassing and elusive irritant. Everyone wants them to talk about time, but they don't have much to say. You, on the other hand, you've come at it head on. You've produced very readable books and good videos, and you've been fascinated with time, or whatever it is our concept of time is getting at, for many years. How did you get interested in this fascinating subject?
Well, first of all, it was a fascination with astronomy. At about the age of 10, I discovered the wonders of the universe, starting with the solar system. And that I was basically then set to become an astrophysicist. And by the age of 26, I was in Munich in Germany, wanting to work on a PhD in astrophysics. But I was getting more and more interested in fundamental physics. And quite by chance, I read a newspaper article about the work of the great British physicist Paul Dirac, who was one of the major discoverers of quantum mechanics. And he'd been trying to put together quantum mechanics with Einstein's wonderful theory of general relativity to make a quantum theory of the universe. And he'd come to a rather surprising conclusion that the famous four-dimensional symmetry of Einstein's theory, where space and time are mixed up and are completely indivisible, he questioned that. He said his work had led him to question that, and he no longer believed that it was a fundamental property, or he doubted it. And this made a big impression on me. And the next morning I woke up and I said, well, if the great Dirac is thinking like that, shouldn't we start thinking, what is time? And I'm still thinking about it now, over 50 years later.
Well, as philosophers, we're very, very glad that you are. But can you give us, in a nutshell, to get us started, some explanation about why physicists are having such a problem with time? I mean, physics, one might have thought, is the science of explaining how events unfold in time. How can it then turn back on its basic concept and doubt that it's real?
Well, there's two things that go into it, really. The major doubt at the moment comes from attempts, which have been going on now for about 60 years, to put together Einstein's theory of general relativity, his theory of gravitation, and quantum mechanics. Now, back in 1905, Einstein had this fantastic insight about the way clocks work and rods. When they're moving at speed relative to you, clocks seem to go slower. And he'd mixed together space and time into what's called space-time. And that there was no longer an independent time, and the concept of a now was different. You couldn't say that it was now in Andromeda and now here in Oxford or now in California. Mm-hmm. And that has been supported by experiments ever since to a tremendous accuracy. But then another 20 years later, quantum mechanics was discovered, and still to this day, quantum mechanics still has a rather old-fashioned Newtonian idea of time, that more or less it flows on continuously, and there is some more or less unique now. And putting those two ideas together has really defeated physicists to this day.
Ah, so it's the physicists have gotten themselves in quite a pickle, right? Einstein is already sending time out the door, at least time as Newton understand it, as the kind of absolute clock of the universe. And quantum mechanics kind of brings it back in, and you guys want to have your cake and eat it too. You want to have both your quantum mechanics and your relativity, and you don't know how to do that? Is that right?
I would say that's a pretty good summary of the situation. Yes, this really became clear in 1967 with work of somebody called Bryce DeWitt, who found an equation, and he'd been badgered into it by John Wheeler. John Wheeler is the man who coined the expression black hole. And John Wheeler was desperate to get this theory of gravitation, so he pushed Bryce DeWitt to find an equation. And when DeWitt finally got this equation, which was meant to describe how the quantum universe works, there was no trace of time in the equation. It had just disappeared.
Oh, my God.
And this has been called the problem of time.
People wonder who lost this, who lost that, and physicists can wonder who lost time. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the reality of time with Julian Barber from the University of Oxford.
Perhaps the concept of time has its limitations, but can we really do without it? Can we live our lives without thinking in terms of the past and the future? Would we want to?
The future and past, the now or the nows. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, we know that time is tight, but does anyone really know what time it is? I'm John Perry, and I know what radio program it is. It's Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about the reality of time.
Our guest is Julian Barber from the University of Oxford, author of The End of Time.
So, Julian, I want to get... Philosophers often deny the reality of different kinds of things, but I want to see what you're exactly saying about our ordinary concept of time. Look, here's how we ordinarily think of it. Our conversation yesterday was in the future. Tomorrow, it will be in the past. Right now, it's in the present. Are you claiming that we're just talking nonsense when we use this kind of temporal vocabulary? Is that just nonsense because it refers to something not possibly existent?
No, I'm not denying that. In fact, I would. My own view on this is that there's a whole lot of nows, a lot of instants, and in a way, really, they all exist. Why? This moment is very vibrant. I'm sitting here in Oxford in the studio talking to you. It's very real. And I was talking to you in conventional way 5 minutes ago. What right have I in this now to say that now no longer exists? From my point of view, I think they all exist. And there isn't some sense of going between them. It's just that in this now, I have what I call memories of other nows. And that leads me to think that there was a time that there's something different out there. Well, they are different because I was saying different things from what I am now. But it's more to do with difference, not with moving between them.
So if all nows are equally real, does that mean that ones we would call the future ones are as real as the past ones? Doesn't that kind of undermine our whole idea of a future that's open and the freedom we have to affect it one way or another?
I don't think so, because there can be lots of different futures. I mean, I drove here by car this afternoon, and I'll go back again, and I still haven't made up my mind which road I'll take back, because there's two very beautiful scenic routes. And it's amazing. It's really going to be, at the last minute, something in my mind will say, I'm going to go that way rather than that way. And I think there's no reason why one shouldn't say that they're both there. This is actually how many people interpret quantum mechanics, that they're all there. That's called the many worlds interpretation.
So let me ask you another. Okay, so it would be one thing. So, okay, moment, the nows are real. But I take it part of your view is that the perceived flow of time from one now to the next now to the next now, that flow is somehow a mere perception on our part. Now, there's still some different things you could be saying. You could say that at the bottom, there is no time, but time is an emergent property. Or you could say, at the bottom, there is no time, but the perception of time is, you know, what philosophers like to call like a secondary quality. It's in our minds, but it's not in the thing. Like some people think color is in our mind, but out there, there's only light waves, right? But there isn't anything that resembles the color, as Locke and other people say. Is it that time is an emergent but real property? The flow of time is an emergent but real property? Or is it that the flow of time is like a merely secondary thing that's only in our perception?
I would say it could be a bit of both. I mean, it's emergent in the sense that in my brain I have what I think of as memories, and they sort of fits together. I can remember the details of the discussion earlier on in this program, and that fits together. And when you make a question, that all fits together. So that leads me to believe in a passage of time. So it's emergent in that sense. But I think the appearance of the flow of time. After all, where do you really see the flow of time most dramatically? It's when you, I think, move your hand in front of your face quickly, and in a sense you see the whole movement, and you know that it begins, say, on the left and it goes across to the right. You see it all at once. And that, I would say, is that could be very much like seeing green, a secondary quality in the sense of Locke and Bishop Berkeley.
So there's usually, often thought to be a close connection between time and causation. Hume had a famous theory of causation in which you define causation in terms of time. But leaving that aside, however one thinks of it, they seem very strongly connected. And causation seems to be at the heart of science. I mean, evolution and natural selection and all these frameworks we have for understanding things scientifically seems to depend on some notion of cause. Now, is causation on this view just going to turn out to be a secondary property, a kind of something that if you destroyed all the brains in the world wouldn't exist?
I think the most important thing is the notion of a law. I'm not a biologist, so I wouldn't want to get into evolution, but in physics, I think the really key thing is a law. And normally one says laws come with initial conditions. But if you're talking about the whole universe, I think that's a bit questionable. I think one just has to look at all the solutions that the law would allow. And then you would say, well, I'm actually in this particular one. This is, so to speak, the where I live in this particular solution that the law allows.
Let me ask you a question somewhat related. It's something that always puzzles me about Einstein and all that. So observers in different frames of reference will have sort of count different events as simultaneous or not simultaneous, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
But I think go on.
But then that always says to me, suppose I'm going to give a complete history of the universe from my frame of reference, and you're going to give a complete history of the universe from your frame of reference. Those histories are going to be different if we're in different frames of reference, and that seems odd to me. Am I missing something? I mean, doesn't the universe have a determinate history, a one determinate history?
That's certainly, before you bring in quantum mechanics, that is very strongly the message which Einstein's theory gives. And this is really one of the problems of trying to reconcile it with quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics would prefer to have a history in many ways. And so I would say these are open issues. Watch this space, really. It's nothing is, I would say, more uncertain than the nature of time at the moment. I mean, ask any two physicists what time is, and you'll probably get two different answers.
Let me go back to your example of your driving home. So the common sense way of look at that would be, or maybe I shouldn't call it common sense, my way of looking at it, which I like to dignify with the term common sense, is that here we are at a moment in time, and Julian has, there are two possibilities. That is, that the future is nothing more than a bunch of possibilities, and at some point you're going to make a decision to go the scenic route or the fast route, and then one of those possibilities will become, in time, the actual part of the actual world, and the others will be mere possibilities. Now, quantum physicists, or some of them, have a different way of looking at it. When you make the decision, and maybe in other certain cases when wave functions collapse, the universe really divides, and each of those things that we thought of as a possibility is really equally real, even after you make your decision. But then, you know, does that mean that you are simultaneously driving home by both routes, but you just can't access them both at the same time? I mean, how are we supposed to think of this dividing universe if it involves a dividing self that ends up driving home in two different ways?
Well, that's what the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, if you take it seriously, forces upon you. And in fact, then this discussion might be going in many different ways. But the point is, of course, you're always in only one, so you don't know about the other one. So that's the way out. You can't be sure the other one isn't just as real as you. And of course, this is mind-boggling, and a lot of people reject this as a possibility, and it's a very open issue. I think one day maybe, but this is way in the future, which I use, it may be that consciousness somehow, if and when we could ever understand it, might give us insight into what is going on. But as of now, it is a distinct possibility. A lot of people who've studied these issues think that you certainly can't dismiss the many worlds interpretation out of hand. It seems to be there in the mathematics. Certainly there's a one way to interpret it.
If I dismiss it out of hand, I may at the same time be embracing it.
So it's kind of
hard to do anything.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the reality of time with Julian Barber. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Bing from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bing.
Well, thank you for your time.
What's your comment or question?
I'm wondering whether time might be a kind of a human conception, because I'm wondering whether we know, and if so, other animals and other living beings, such as trees and whatnot, on Earth, have an experience of time, of the past and present and future.
Well, that's a good question, Bing. I will say, let's distinguish having time consciousness. I mean, humans have time consciousness, and other animals may or may not have time consciousness. And there's a question about where human time consciousness comes from, but that doesn't settle this issue about the reality of time. Wouldn't you agree, Julian?
The reality of time or what exactly we're to think of it, that remains open. But certainly I would think that what we call time is not just peculiar to human beings, because we once had a dog who was a smart guy, and he certainly remembered things. So at least that left some trace in his brain from what had happened to him earlier. So I'm pretty certain that things that we would associate with time are present really throughout the world. And one of the great mysteries, I mean, one of the marvels of the universe, is how everything does fit together and how we can make a coherent history of the Earth. That's a great miracle, really.
So, but can I go back just briefly to my thing about the observers in the different frames of reference? Now, if they somehow managed to communicate and they could share histories, I mean, would their histories have at least a similar time order, you know, event one happened before event, or would they disagree about what happened before what, and would their histories all at least converge on the Big Bang happening at the same moment in there, you know?
Well, my understanding, which probably isn't too great, is that if A causes B from any perspective, it will occur before it from all perspectives.
That's what I'm wondering. Yes.
Yeah. So is that kind of understanding at least correct?
That's certainly correct within Einstein's mm-hmm. theory. I should say that to some extent, this business about the different notions of simultaneity that different observers have, that's partly a theoretical construction. I mean, if one observer is, if you have two observers at the same point and one is moving relative to the other, they actually see more or less the same thing on the sky. It's just distorted in a very characteristic way. So all the information they pick up is actually identical. And when you get beyond the special theory of relativity into the general theory of relativity, it's not quite so easy to pin that down. But there is a clear notion of causality within Einstein's theory, at least. It gets more complicated when you get into quantum mechanics again.
Yeah. So we seem to have a dilemma. If we stick with Einstein, we get something like causality. We have to give up a little bit about time, like simultaneity, but we get to keep quite a bit. If we go with original quantum mechanics, we get Newtonian space and time, But it's not clear we have any events anymore. You know, you got cats all over the world that are alive and dead at the same time. And now, with the new quantum mechanics, we get the best of both worlds. We get no time, and we don't have any events we can understand either. You physicists are doing a great job.
Thank you for that. Well, I have to say, it's pretty chaotic at the moment, but that may be... Who can tell? Maybe somebody will come along and have just a brilliant insight, and suddenly it'll all fall into place. You know, we may well be waiting for another Einstein.
G from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Velocity Dog, G.
Yes. One of my favorite quotes ever that I recite all the time is by the Buddha. It goes, "My teachings are like a finger pointing to the moon. Do not mistake my finger for the moon." And for me, how that relates towards time is I see time as a finger that humanity uses to orient itself towards truth, towards reality as it is. And I see science and philosophy and art doing much the same thing, trying to orient us to a meaningful definition of an objective reality so that we can correspond with it in a way that affirms life, I guess, if you want to put it that way. I'm curious what y'all think of that.
Thanks for the question, G. Julian, you got anything directly to say about that?
Well, I would basically agree. I think every scientist is trying to find truth and understand what is going on, and it's a very beautiful comment from the Buddha.
Yes, but one point I take it is this. Even if you turned out to be right that there is no time, that time doesn't flow or something like that, would that mean that we should actually revise any of our practices in terms of keeping and measuring time and narrating our lives as unfolding over time? Would that force us to, like, radically accepting the truth of there is no time? Would that force us to radically revise any of what we're up to?
Well, let me say first, whichever way we think about time, one thing that I think is really magical is the experience of now, that completely unexpected thing that happens to you and you realize it's now. And I certainly am a great believer in appreciating the now, carpe diem, enjoy the day, make the most of it. That I certainly believe. Let me also say that in recent years, I've become to think that maybe there is some sort of time a little bit like what people might think. This is more recent development, so maybe it's appropriate that I'm called Julian, because Julian the Apostate was that Roman emperor after Constantine who went back to paganism. I'm slightly flirting with the idea that there is some kind of time. It's nothing remotely like Newton's, but maybe it's there. So perhaps I'm keeping an open mind.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the nature of time with Julian Barber, author of The End of Time.
They say time marches on, but... does time have a direction?
The Arrow of Time, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Time after time, one thing after another. Is that all there is to time? Is that all there is to everything? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Julian Barber from the University of Oxford, and we're asking about the reality of time. You got an email there, right, John?
Yeah, we got quite a few emails. We won't be able to get through them all, but here's one. Phenomenologists, according to Paul in San Francisco, have been very interested in time. They believe in the flow of time, or at least that it seems like time flows. As Ken said, this program started out in the future. Now it's in the present. Tomorrow it'll be in the past. How does the British idealist MacTaggart's view of time relate to this comparison, Paul asked. Well, I've spent a lot of time with MacTaggart, so I'll say that to me, MacTaggart's got a kind of orthogonal problem to the one we've been discussing, but it may not turn out to be as orthogonal as one thinks. MacTaggart says, well, look at a calendar. Think of the objective reality behind the calendar. That means that events occur in this order before and after. But one thing the calendar won't tell you is what's now. It won't capture that flow of time. That's what he calls the B series, which the calendar gives us, and the A series, which is how we experience things. And he says the two can't be brought into a coherent connection, and therefore they're both involved in our idea of time, and therefore time is unreal. So maybe McTaggart was onto a bifurcation or notion of time, and now physics seems to be into two different ways that don't fit together, relativity theory and quantum physics. Does either relativity or quantum physics, a question for, I guess, have a theory of now, of what it is, well, for an event in this great universe to be
Julie,
present?
You have a theory of now, but it's multiple nows, which seems like not a theory of now, but...
Yeah, but I'm only, this, not me, is only in one at the moment, I would say that. But I have to say, listening to McTaggart always confuses me, so perhaps we better start again on the question.
Well,
on
but
that.
What distinguishes this moment as now, right? What makes this moment my now? There must be some special relationship that I have to it, but I have to it now.
Well, now I think this is where consciousness does come into it. I mean, I certainly am aware of this now, and it has got lots of, to use a philosophical phrase, it's got lots of attributes which distinguish it from any other now. And to that extent, it's real. And I think that is very important.
So for each consciousness, all the things that occur in the vicinity and at the same time as the consciousness are its now. But that I don't know if that's going to work. But maybe we should get back to the arrow of time, because this is one thing our listeners will have heard of, and it's a fascinating issue. It certainly seems that time has a direction from the Big Bang, or God saying, let it be, or was that the Beatles? Anyway, from the Big Bang through all the past to right now and on into the future. But physicists, I'm told, have a problem finding this arrow, or they don't find it, as you might think, at the really most basic level of things. It kind of emerges from complex phenomena. Can you tell us a little about the arrow of time and why you guys are having such trouble finding it?
Yeah, I could certainly say something about that, but easier than McTaggart. Now, the problem about the arrow of time, which was recognized about 120, 130 years ago, above all by the great Boltzmann, was that the laws of nature, so far as we know, both Newton's and Einstein's, they all seem to be what they call time reversal symmetric. They don't distinguish a direction of time. You could think of it as a washing line on which there's no arrow pointed like that. And the various instants of time, the nows, are like bits of washing hanging on the line. Mm. But what is clear is that although the laws suggest there shouldn't be any distinct direction as you go along the washing line, the fact is that there is. And the famous examples are to do with the increase of entropy. Things tend to get more disordered. If you drop an egg, it'll break and you can't put it together again. So that was a great mystery over 100 years ago, and it is still a hot topic and a mystery. And basically, the only suggestion people have come up with at the moment is that it's something to do with the nature of the Big Bang, that the Big Bang started in a very special way with a low entropy, a very ordered state, and since then it's been getting more and more disordered. So that's the conventional thing, and that's called the past hypothesis, that there was a very special initial state.
Can I give you a Kantian thought? that this arrow of time is really just, it's in a sense subjective, but I don't mean that arbitrary. I mean, so Kant said we have these categories of causation and interaction, and to perceive the arrow of time is nothing but, it's not to perceive time moving, it's nothing but perceiving causality. The arrow of time is just constituted by the antecedent bringing about the consequence. We have this kind of antecedent consequence machinery in our head. We cognize the universe as having a causal direction, and time is nothing but, you know, kind of an expression of the causal direction of the universe. So it's not that time moves in some way. It's just a way of perceiving causation, the causal dependency relations. What do you think about that kind of thought?
Well, I think you don't have to go... I have difficulty with causation. I would say you can just look around you at the universe. The astronomers look through their telescopes and they see that the universe looks very different in what we all agree is the distant past, and its structure is just very different now. And we see this on the Earth, we see it in the fossil record. I mean, the evidence that there is a direction of change, that basically that things are getting more complicated and more interesting, that is really, I think, undeniable. Now, it's all here in the present. All the evidence we have for the past of the Earth is really sitting in rocks and fossils, unchanging. So it's really in the structure of the rocks and fossils that we deduce this arrow of time, this direction. I think that's a fact that's independent of any ideas we have about causality.
Well, that seems to lead up to your notion of a time capsule, which I found quite fascinating. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, this is, I mean, if you think about 200 years ago, when people thought that the world was only just over 6,000 years old, the geologists, they started looking carefully at the Earth. They looked at fossils, they looked at rocks, and then they found all sorts of connections between things. There were similarities. The fossils in different layers changed slightly, and they began to say to themselves, how could this come about? And they asked the question, really what the Greeks said about science, it's to explain phenomena. You find something which is very striking, and you say, how can this be? And they said, after a bit, they said, well, the only thing this could have produced this is that there was some process that took place over a long period of time in accordance with laws, and this is the outcome of the process. And they discovered deep time. They came to the conclusion that the Earth was immensely ancient, much older than the physicists at that time thought. And if you stop and think about it, the evidence is essentially unchanged that they based that on. It's still there now. It's in static configurations. It's unchanged. And I would say this is very powerful evidence for the past and for the existence of something we call time. But it's all, ironically, it's in something that is essentially unchanging.
So you think that each moment in time, as it were, bears kind of witness to its relationship to other moments in time. And so that's how we know it, that's how it's possible for us to know anything about time. It's not because time flows, it's because each moment bears witness to other moments in time. There's like a bunch of pointers to other moments in time. Is that
exactly? I would say that the past is a conclusion that we draw from the present. We deduce the existence of the past from the present. I would say there's only two pieces of evidence really that there is a sort of a past and a present. Is the one I already mentioned of moving my hand. When I see my hand, when I see the motion, that tells me, you know, it started there and it ended there and I saw it all. That's one bit of strong evidence. And the other, I think, is in all this incredible agreement between all the different things that science finds. It's just staggering. From astronomy, cosmology, DNA, it's in the rocks, and everything conspires together to tell this one story. It grows to a thing of great consistency, to quote a line from Shakespeare.
George in San Francisco, you'll probably be our last caller. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, George.
Well, we wanted to make one suggestion, and that is the substitution of a single word, where we try to describe time as the flight of an arrow, or is suggested by the flight of an arrow along a particular arc. Suppose we replace the word arrow with the word displacement when we think of time, and see how that challenges us to come up with another feeling about what time is.
The displacement of time instead of the arrow of time?
Displacement of time instead of the arrow of time.
Thanks, George. Can you make sense of that, Julia?
Well, I would say I would prefer to talk about displacement of things. I mean, I'm sitting in Oxford still at the moment, but I trust in an hour or so's time I will be back in my home in North Oxfordshire. And I've been displaced. So I would say that we talk about time and we think of time because things change. There was a great saying of Ernst Mach, who greatly influenced Einstein, it's utterly impossible to measure the changes of things by time. Much rather, time is an abstraction at which we arrive from the changes of things.
Another great philosopher deserves a mention here as we're about to end this topic is Leibniz, right? You sound like a Leibnizian. Time is just something, and space is just about the order of relation among things. There's no independent space, there's no independent time. So are you a Leibnizian?
Oh, absolutely, yes. No, I think he's a terrific philosopher. He's had a huge influence on me. Of course, he wasn't nearly as great a scientist in a way that Newton was. So he had a great debate with Newton, and initially he lost it. But I think in the long run, Leibniz will be the winner on that issue.
Well, on that exhilarating note, Julian, this has been a great conversation, and it's flowed like it. Taken all, it felt like it didn't even happen in time. It was so wonderful. So thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Our guest has been Julian Barber. He's a visiting professor of physics at the University of Oxford, author of The End of Time, The Next Revolution in Physics. So, John, may I ask what you're thinking now?
What am I thinking now? Well, one thing I'm thinking is that in addition to his books and writings, he has a wonderful video that we may already have on our website on the Community of Thinkers, but if not, I think we'll definitely get it up. We definitely appreciate the efforts of this great physicist to communicate to us mere philosophers about where physics is with time. On the other hand, hearing what a muddle they made of it, I feel better about the philosophy of time.
Well, you know, you can have more conversations with Julian because he's going to be on our live chat Friday, May 23rd at noon as part of our Community of Thinkers. Go to philosophytalk.org Friday, May 23rd at noon on our community. And you can dig in more to these really deep and puzzling questions. I mean, physics is, you know, people, there are some physicists who say philosophy is useless, but, you know, philosophers have been thinking about this very puzzle for a very long time, and I was really pleased that Julian said Leibniz was a great philosopher. But, you know, as I said, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And I do want to say as a final word, thanks to all those emailers we didn't get time to get to. Some excellent questions remained on the cutting room floor. Now here's someone with very little time on his hands, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, here's some news from the New York Times about how fragmented time will be fragmented even further in the future. Reporter Quentin Hardy points out, quote, long documents printed out from PCs gave way to shorter emails and attachments on laptops. These became even shorter and faster to send texts on cell phones. The cost and nuance is apparently compensated for by more back-and-forth collaboration and urgency, unquote. He then quotes the chief executive of Evernote, a company that allows users to store photos, business cards, and notes online, or in the cloud, as they say, quote, we used to interact with personal computers daily for 2 or 3 hours at a time. With laptops, we started interacting 3 or 4 times a day for 20 minutes each. Mobile phones made that into sessions of 2 minutes, 50 times a day, unquote. And by the time you start to pay attention, your time's already up. And in the world to come of smartwatches, Google Glass, and the Internet of Things, in which your milk will send you a tweet when it's about to go sour, this same executive predicts we will be having sessions of 10 seconds each, 1,000 times a day. Well, who am I to argue with the New York Times, but anecdotally at least, I interact with my personal computer daily for about 8 hours. My laptop only when I'm not around my personal computer, my mobile phone, well, maybe an hour a week, if that. I don't live the newfangled way, chained to the cloud, I guess, but then again, I'm old, and my sight's too bad to watch anything on my smartphone, much less a 10-second PowerPoint presentation. So if in the future we will indeed be having sessions of only 10 seconds each, 1,000 times a day, I will not be a participant. Come to think of it, I don't know anybody who lives this way. I'm sure they're out there, techie entrepreneurial hipsters with a strong work ethic, ambition to burn, good eyesight, and the attention span of a kitten, but they're off caressing their startup billions, not interacting with the ilks of me. And I have to ask, what does this executive mean by sessions? Now, there are FTP sessions, dog training sessions, even Vatican Council sessions, but when I think sessions, I think time spent with a therapist, with a coach, or a personal trainer, or an all-night studio jam with Stephen Stills. It's more than a meeting, in other words, less than a tropical getaway. Whatever it is, if it only lasts 10 seconds, in my opinion, it is not a session. It's a blip, a stutter, a yawn, a burp, a wrinkle, a hiccup, a beg pardon, a come again. Didn't quite catch that. Don't call me again, you hear? How'd you even get this number? I'm hanging up, walking away. There won't be another session, my friend. It's a waste of 10 seconds, frankly. Also, newsflash, the data isn't really in a cloud, you know. I'm not tech savvy, but I do know that what actually contains our data is a thing called a server. I think of it as a filing cabinet in somebody else's house that has my stuff in it. You can call it a cloud if you want. That's not what it is, but okay. Maybe we can book a branding session to talk about it. Should take all of, I don't know, I can schedule 3 seconds. Then I have a 7-second phoner at 10. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks for thinking too.
Hey, Les. You got a minute?
For you, Brad, I got five.